This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of May 14th, here are a few top stories. In the news, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody and Sarah Ventry.
Big changes were made last night in the tiny town of Hilldale, Utah. Hilldale, along with Colorado City, Arizona, makes up the community of Short Creek, which is home to the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry has been following those changes and is there now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Mark.
So I understand there was a series of three events last night. Let's start with the biggest one.
Okay, so the most significant one is that the mayor of Hilldale announced that the city is withdrawing its appeal of the judge's rulings in a Justice Department lawsuit from 2016. Now, I know that sounds like a mouthful of legalese, but here's what happened. So in 2016, the Justice Department filed suit against the towns for religious discrimination, and it argued that the towns and a number of municipal operations and employees were acting as arms of the FLDS church and discriminating against non-church members. So the DOJ won that lawsuit, and then the judge in the case issued a handful of orders that required specific things from the towns and its departments, things that are supposed to fix the problem and ensure that no one is treated unfairly.
Like what?
Like requiring a mentor for the police department to make sure there's no abuse of power, or requiring that land in the community, which had previously been owned by the church, that land be divided up so that individuals could own it.
Ah, okay. So then what was the appeal?
So the towns had argued the entire case that they were not engaging in a pattern of discrimination. In fact, they actually argued that the federal government was discriminating against FLDS members. So the towns appealed the judge's ruling, which is not so surprising. Now that appeal is still held up in the courts, but Hilldale is in the process of withdrawing from that appeal. The twist is that Colorado City is not withdrawing. And since the two towns operate as one community, that's a little bit complicated. So both mayors have said that they plan to continue to work with the neighboring city, and they don't anticipate any issues in doing that. As for what that means for the Arizona side, which is keeping the appeal, here's Colorado City Mayor Joseph Allred.
The orders of the court have laid out a lot of specific requirements, and I think we're doing well in the compliance with those, and we have the spirit of wanting to comply, and we want to go forward. We want to serve the citizens well and fairly.
So, Sarah, it seems like a positive sign that both mayors at least want to continue working together.
Definitely. The one thing to keep in mind, though, is that the Hilldale City Council is now made up of all non-FLDS members, and the Colorado City Council is currently all FLDS members. So there's still a lot of underlying tension in the community between some church and non-church members, but yes, you are right. Both mayors definitely seem to want to make it work.
All right, so speaking of the City Council, one of the other big changes last night was the election of two new council members.
Yes. Hilldale actually just had an election back in November that you might remember, but there were two new city council members elected last night. So in November's election, there were three vacancies on the council plus the mayorship, and then there were two already remaining councilors who were not up for re-election. One of those two resigned, citing work conflicts as the reason why he was unable to attend council meetings. The other is Brian Jessup, and as I understand it, he kind of just stopped responding to the council. They weren't really able to reach him, but he is also currently embroiled in a lawsuit in which he's accused of using child labor. So the council was down two members, and they had to elect two new people, but they did this according to Utah state code, which in this case actually does not have the people vote. Instead, the candidates all have a chance to speak publicly about why they want the position, and then the three existing council members voted. So both of the new council members are excited to serve. They say they're ready to do the hard work that's ahead of them. Here's one of them speaking at the meeting. This is Lawrence Barlow. He's a longtime community member who's worked in emergency services, and here's a little bit of what he had to say.
I've had many years of exposure to the institutions and systems that have worked well in the past. And I've observed over the past several years that the workability has diminished. I would like to see us take the best from the past and bring it forward.
All right, so Sarah, the third big thing?
is that three new police officers were sworn into the Colorado City Marshal's office, which is undergoing its own changes. The police chief was fired in March, and as I mentioned before, that department is working with a court-appointed mentor, and at least one person last night who was running for one of the vacant city council seats mentioned distrust of the police department as a big problem in town. So those new officers have some big challenges ahead of them, but they all seemed excited and proud to step into their new roles.
All right. Certainly lots happening up in Short Creek. That's the show, Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
The Arizona State Board for Charter Schools this week approved requests by Basis Charter Schools to expand in Flagstaff and Mesa. The unanimous vote came after some board members questioned school officials about their asking parents for donations to supplement teacher salaries and using Arizona tax money as collateral to finance out-of-state expansion. Earlier in the week, we heard from Craig Harris of the Arizona Republic, who's looked into Basis. Today, we hear from Deanna Rowe, Basis Charter Schools Executive Director. And Deanna, how important to Basis is the decision the Charter Board made to allow this expansion in Flagstaff and in Mesa?
Well, expanding Basis so that more kids can attend is great news for the families and the communities of Mesa and Flagstaff, and it's great news for education in Arizona. Over the last several years, we've added schools and expanded the grade-level offerings across our state. And the action by the Charter Board this week provides those communities with the full spectrum of kindergarten through 12th grade now at the base, through the Basis program.
Is there a target in mind for how big you would like Basis to ultimately be in Arizona?
Basis would love the opportunity to provide academic programs for every family that would like to have access to the Basis program.
Do you have a sense of how many schools you would need? I mean, is that something you're realistically looking into?
We have long-term goals to continue to expand in the state, looking at where the demand is from our current families, you know, as indicated by some of the information of families who are on our wait list, and then looking at other areas that aren't currently served by quality educational opportunities that might benefit from a Basis school in their community.
How would that work if, for example, every student in Arizona could theoretically go to a Basis school? I mean, what would that do to traditional district schools?
I did not mean to imply that Basis schools should be the only educational opportunity for all students. But I believe that all students should have the choice for a high-quality school.
Let me ask you about the issue of expansion, because obviously there's been some reporting recently about how Basis uses collateral for acquiring new facilities, especially in other states. And I'm wondering if you are comfortable telling Arizona taxpayers that they basically have nothing to worry about if facilities that you have in Arizona, which are obviously paid for in part, you get taxpayer money here. Can you tell Arizona taxpayers that they do not have anything to worry about if a facility, a school in another state runs into financial problems when you've used maybe some of your schools here as collateral?
Absolutely. I feel very confident and comfortable in assuring Arizona's taxpayers that their dollars are not at risk in the way that we have invested for the expansion of our schools in Arizona and across the country. I think it's important to remember that charter schools in Arizona receive less taxpayer funding than district public schools, and charter schools have to provide their own facilities. So we rely on private investors for capital infrastructure, and when borrowing, when we bundle Arizona properties with our out-of-state assets, it enables Basis to achieve a lower interest rate, which saves us millions of dollars over the life of the loan, and those monies can then be spent in our Arizona classrooms.
How important is it for Basis to continue expanding to reach the company's financial goals and keep it, you know, financially viable?
Well, certainly Basis ensures that it is absolutely financially viable. Every independent financial expert that has reviewed our financials has given Basis Finances a clean bill of health. You need to remember that Arizona's real crisis here is that too few students have access to quality education. And when you look at our school's performance and our rankings, taxpayers are certainly getting their money's worth. And given we accomplished these results with less funding than our district counterparts, you could say that taxpayers are getting a real bargain.
Is Basis's financial health really okay? I mean, it's been reported that the company is running a bit of a deficit, and whether or not that's, you know, an accounting thing or an actual thing, it seems as though, at least on paper anyway, that the company's financial health is maybe a bit more perilous than that.
So I think it's key, yes, absolutely. Basis's financial health is strong. And as you indicated, those financial losses are absolutely only on paper and are largely attributable to two factors: non-cash expenses for depreciation of facilities and the refinancing of our debt.
I want to ask you also about the issue of teacher pay, because there was another bit of reporting that indicated that Basis requests donations from parents of Basis students to help fund teacher pay. How big of a part of what teachers get are those donations? How important is it for teachers to make a competitive salary that parents of their students donate?
So our Basis salaries are competitive. The average salary for a Basis teacher is nearly $2,100 more than the Arizona statewide average starting salary. When it comes to the parent or family donations, those donations are used to provide merit bonuses for our teachers in addition to their salaries.
All right. Deanna Rowe is Executive Director for Basis Charter Schools. Deanna, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody with something a little different.
Okay, Mark, remember that dress that was obviously blue and black, but in some photos it looked white and gold?
Yeah, you mean the white and gold dress that in some photos looked blue and black?
All right, sure. The one that the internet went crazy over. So the internet
Yes.
Now has brought us another heated debate about the senses. Not a picture this time, but an audio clip.
Well, that's good for us.
Exactly, for radio here. The clip was posted on Twitter on Monday, and it has gone viral because different people hear different things from the same clip. So here it is. Take a listen.
Laurel.
Okay, so clearly that says Laurel, right?
It does not. I hear Yanny.
How? I don't understand.
It's just
that at all.
There's a very obvious long E at the end of that to my ears anyway.
Gosh, I do not hear it. Okay, so some people like me who are right swear that they hear Laurel, and some say there's no way it could be anything other than Yanny.
Because there is no way it can be anything other than Yanny. But the question is, because, you know, Lauren and I have different opinions on this, how can people hear two different words from the same piece of audio?
Okay, so that has been the question in the first hour since that first tweet. So some people have said they can hear both at once. Others say the clip sounds different on different devices. But it has become pretty clear that both words do exist in the same piece of audio at the same time, however loyal you might be to Team Yanny or Team Laurel. So we tasked our producer, Annika Klein, with helping us break this down. So she removed some of the high frequencies from the original clip. Here's what that sounds like.
Laurel.
Now that is totally Laurel.
Right. Okay. So that's what I heard too. But there's also this clip with some of the low frequencies removed.
Yanny,
right?
No, I still hear Laurel.
Still? Man. So if this were a song, Laurel would probably be like the bass drum and Yanny would maybe be, I don't know, like a falsetto?
Right. And if you switch between those process clips and the original, things start sounding really weird.
Oof, I think I'm going to avoid that.
From the business desk. Here's KJZZ's Phil Latzman.
And let's talk basketball for a moment. While their NBA brothers, the Suns, finished with the league's worst record, hopes do remain high for the Phoenix Mercury, who are still a force to be reckoned with in the Women's National Basketball Association. Led by the league's all-time leading scorer, Diana Taurasi, and dominant center Brittany Griner, the three-time champs once again have title aspirations. However, this season may be as much about babies as it is about basketball. The Mercury has had a baby boom, and they're counting on that baby bump to put them over the top. Forward Dawana Bonner has spent the past year not thinking much about basketball.
I'm very tired every day, but I think I'm getting used to it now. It's been 9 months, so I'm kind of used to not getting any sleep, but I wouldn't change it for the world. It's so rewarding.
Bonner, or DB as her teammates call her, gave birth to twin girls last year with wife Candace Dupree of the WNBA's Indiana Fever. She returns to the Merck after taking 2017 off to care for them. And now it is back to work.
It's really hard to, you know, get back in shape. It's really hard to get that build back. It's really hard to get that mentality back where you can just play like 40 minutes straight and not get tired. But it's a process, and then you have to just kind of go with it. You can't force yourself and rush yourself and get frustrated. I got frustrated plenty of times. Like, I made this shot 50 times now. I can't even hit the rim, you know.
Though not having gone through labor herself, Diana Taurasi is also a new mother. The soon-to-be 36-year-old WNBA legend enters her 14th season. Her wife is former Mercury forward and director of player development, Penny Taylor, who gave birth to their first child, son Leo, earlier this year.
It gives me a greater appreciation of what mothers have to do, because it's double time. No one's doing the stuff that we have to do and still, you know, pursue a career. It's an amazing thing, and not a lot of people can do it. It's definitely not me.
In fact, there are so many new babies around the Mercury that they recently opened a nursery at Talking Stick Arena. Jim Pittman is the team's executive vice president.
To my knowledge, we're the first in the league to have a full-time nursery. We have a pediatric nurse as our nanny. You know, we're trying to make sure that we do provide the things that make our athletes successful.
The full-time nursery may be new, but women athletes in the WNBA having children is not.
Cheryl Swoops was pregnant and had her son and came back and played. We've had Helen Darling, who had triplets, came back and played. So we've had plenty of women, Tina Thompson, Lisa Leslie. We've had plenty of women that have come back and played.
That's Ann Myers Drysdale. She's the Mercury vice president and a team broadcaster. She's also a groundbreaking former player who's a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame.
And it's been proven that women actually perform better after childbirth. And so whether it's basketball or volleyball or soccer or tennis or golf, whatever the sport.
We're women. It's great that, you know, you can have children and still come back and play, because that's what we do.
That's the voice of Mercury head coach Sandy Brondello, who's also a former player.
It shows you that you can have balance in your life. And it's, you know, I never played after having children. So I think that's much harder, because there's lack of sleep. You know, all the mothers in the room, we just lack sleep, but we get used to it.
Diana Taurasi says being a mom to a newborn has given her a new appreciation for the game of life and basketball.
You know, it really is a full-time job. You have to be there. You have to have that care and love. And it's been an amazing experience. It's really made me appreciate all my friends and family and my parents a lot more. And, you know, here in the Mercury, it's a different vibe this year. You know, there's a lot invested in a lot of things.
And Dawana Bonner, who also has help from her family and nannies, says she's as excited to be reunited with her teammates as they are to have one of their best players back in the lineup.
Oh, it was a bittersweet kind of thing. I knew what was the end result in 9 months. I was going to have these beautiful babies. But then again, I'm like, oh, my team is struggling a little bit. I wish I was there to help. I wish I can play.
It's been said of the famous dance duo of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers that Rogers had the far harder job, having to dance backwards and with heels on during their famous cinematic routines. Well, just replace the high heels with high tops, as these ladies backpedal and hit the backboards on the basketball court. The baby booming Mercury open their regular season tomorrow night as they host the Dallas Wings. And you're listening to Morning Edition on 91.5.
You're listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the KJZZ Science Desk, here's the show's Lauren Gilger with a story that takes us back to the future.
Hey, Doc, you better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads.
So that movie was made almost 20 years ago, and in it they go back to the future. And do you guys know what year they go to, what year the future is?
I don't honestly remember,
but I do know that my flux capacitor needs to be fixed.
Okay, so the future in Back to the Future is 2015.
Okay, so Lauren, it's 2018. Where's my flying car?
Exactly. Well, Uber might have an answer to that question for us. The company held a summit last week called Uber Elevate, and they showcased a prototype of, get this, a flying taxi. Graham Warwick is technology editor for Aviation Week, and he follows this kind of personal air travel beat. And he can tell us whether or not flying cars are actually going to become a reality in the future here. So I asked him first to describe for us what it is we're exactly talking about. Are these really flying cars?
No, we're not. What we're talking about, they call them air taxis, and taxis is probably a sort of a better analogy. This is a vehicle that you will book a ride in. Think about basically a tiny airliner flying over a city. So this is not like something that an individual would use that you would go out and buy and fly. Mm-hmm. It's more like booking a ticket on an airline, except you're going to be, it's going to be four seats and you're going to be flying short distances over a city. But it's very much a, you know, a commercial air transport service and not an individual car-like experience.
All right. Tell us a little bit about how it would work. There would be helicopter pads on top of buildings?
Yes. So they call them skyports or vertiports, and they would have these electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles that would be operating from these. They would pretty much be on top of existing buildings, parking lots. But the idea is that over time there would be enough demand that they would build their own, you know, own buildings that would be dedicated to this. But fundamentally what you'd do is you would have your smartphone, and very much like you do your Uber at the moment, you mm-hmm. would put in your destination, and they would come back and they would offer you you know, the usual options. It would be, you know, whether it's Uber Black or Uber X, but it would also say Uber Air. So you would just look and it would give you a price, and you would, if you're in a hurry to get somewhere or if the traffic's really bad that day, you would just hit Uber Air, and they would then send an Uber ground vehicle to pick you up, take you to the skyport. You would go up to the top floor of the skyport. Your air taxi would be waiting. You would fly the short distance. You know, they're only talking about, you know, within a city, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
You would, you know, a 10-minute flight or something like that. You would land at another skyport. You'd get out. You'd go down to the ground, and your Uber ground vehicle would be waiting to take you the last bit of your journey.
Wow.
It's very much multimodal, i.e., you know, they see this as having ground and air transport being sort of interconnected, so that you would get one trip that included both the car to get you there to the skyport, and the car to get you back, you know, to the skyport, to wherever your destination is.
And Uber obviously is one of the companies putting out some prototypes right now.
Uber is really taking the lead on this. They've articulated this vision, very detailed vision that they have, and they're really way out in front at the moment. They're really pulling this industry along. But the belief is that, you know, if this takes off and if this works, that over time other folks would, you know, would want to provide similar services. The technology is pretty much there for the vehicles, but there's an awful lot of other stuff has to happen. You know, this has to be on the ground and in the air for this to happen. And Uber really has that network capability to help it all happen.
So talk a little bit about that. What needs to happen? They're working with a development company right now, right in Dallas, to sort of prototype some of these.
Yeah, their intention is to do prototype demonstration flights in Dallas and Los Angeles in 2020. Now, this would be experimental aircraft, you know, prototype aircraft. And it wouldn't be a commercial service. You wouldn't be able to buy tickets. But they'll be flying. The idea is to fly people. And they're really doing that to understand the noise of these vehicles and the public acceptance of this vehicle. Noise is a huge issue, because the reason there are no helicopters in most cities these days, or very few helicopters in most cities these days, there's lots of helipads, but there's not many helicopters.
Right.
The reason is the noise of the helicopters. They're not very quiet. And so the big thing they're trying to do is with these new types of vehicles, which are electric powered and have very different designs to helicopters, they're trying to prove that these vehicles will blend into the background of city noise. And if they can prove that they can be that quiet, they believe that's sort of the key to unlocking the capability to then scale up.
So I was going to ask, how realistic is this? But it sounds like it's already inevitable.
Uber has a very aggressive timescale, and most of the people looking at it, don't think it will happen on the timescale that they think. They're pretty sure they can have these prototypes flying by 2020 because there's a lot of companies working on them now. There are already some of these vehicles flying today. I mean, there are prototypes flying today that would do the job, certainly for the demonstrations. But, you know, to get an FAA-certified vehicle into service by 2023, to have all of the airspace, you know, all the things you need to get permission to fly around the city, all the things you need to get, you know, landing sites and all. There's a lot of people saying that's going to be hard to do by 2023.
So there is, though, the question, like you mentioned, of regulation of the FAA. What have they said about this at this point, the agency?
The FAA, they sort of publicly say they don't see any reason why they can't do this. But I mean, you know, there's a lot of work to be done with the FAA to enable this. So that these vehicles, they're only just beginning to appear now. So nobody's gone to the FAA and said, how do I certify one of these vehicles?
Right.
But all of them are working with the FAA. I mean, the FAA is aware of them. The FAA knows what these vehicles are going to be like. So they're working with them to say, right, how do we make sure they're safe? So we're headed in the right direction. But the thing that's impressive is that Uber is not playing down how difficult this is.
Right.
And it's putting an awful lot of effort into tackling those problems. And it's got a lot of partnerships with people to try to enable this to happen. So if anybody can make it happen, it's Uber as it currently plans at the moment. I mean, there's a huge effort underway. But there are an awful lot of pieces to be put in place before it happens.
That's Graham Warwick, technology editor for Aviation Week, telling us about the future of Uber's air taxis. So get ready, guys, flying cars.
And finally, from the Fronteras desk, those who live in Flagstaff, Page, and Fredonia may see a tax increase this fall. The Coconino County Board of Supervisors voted Tuesday to tax residents to control flooding. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
For the last 3 decades, Flagstaff, Page, and Fredonia residents were exempt from flood control taxes as those cities manage their own floodplains. But outside legal counsel has recommended the county levy taxes. What does this mean for taxpayers? To meet the district's current budget of $2.2 million, the owner of a $300,000 home would pay $54 a year. The County Board of Supervisors could choose to lower or raise that tax. The money would go to projects like the seed planting and berm building needed after the Schultz fire and forest thinning to prevent future wildfires. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.